Good morning. We'll call this meeting of the House Fisheries Committee to order. The time is 10:03 a.m. Members present at this time, Representative Andy Story, Representative Jonathan Christ Tompkins, Representative Dan Ortiz, and myself, Representative Tarr. Please let the record reflect that we do have a quorum to conduct business. We'd ask everyone to silence their cell phones at this time. We're going to have an abbreviated meeting because we do have the joint session for U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan coming up at 11, so we'll try to wrap up no later than 10:50 to give everybody some time to get upstairs. Thank you so much to Shannon McCain, our committee secretary, and Lydia Klein from the Juno LIO for your support today. Thank you so much. We appreciate it. And then just wanted to make note, hopefully everyone saw in your inbox that we received a letter from the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute requesting $20 million in federal rescue relief funds. We also received a letter in support of this funding from United Fishermen of Alaska, so hopefully everyone saw that in their inbox. And then for today's agenda, we just have one item, House Bill 397, State Ownership of Submerged Land. We started to hear this bill on March 22nd, and then we received follow-up information from the department on March 30th. And so everyone should have the follow-up information that we received on March 30th. And so what we were going to do is first take a look at those questions, because we didn't want to bring the bill back before the committee until having had a chance to review the answers to those questions. And then we have a couple of folks online, John Sturgeon and Mike Sewright, who are going to provide some invited testimony. And so try to give about 10 minutes for each of them. So we have a good portion of time here to get started with this. So from the department, we have Jim Walker, Public Access Assertion and Defense from DNR, and then Christy Coles, Division Operations Manager, Division of Mining, Land, and Water from DNR. And it sounds like Ms. Coles, that you might be the one who's going to walk us through the responses to the questions and this from this document that we received on March 30th.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Christy Cullis, and yes, I'm the Chief of Operations for the Division of Mining, Land, and Water. And Chair Tarr, yes, I can answer any questions. I did have a prepared statement, so however you'd like to proceed when it comes to the permitting process, I can assist with that.
Okay, why don't we hear your prepared statement, Ms. Cullis. Thank you. Sorry about the mispronunciation. And then we'll go over the March 30th document and then see what other questions folks might have.
Great. All right. So for the use of state-owned lands that exceed generally allowed uses that are defined by our regulation 11AAC 96.020, they require a DMLW authorization that's pursuant to constitutional, statutory, and administrative mandates. Currently, the division works with federal agencies in authorizing their use of state uplands, tidelands, and submerged lands in areas that state ownership is certain. The division does not receive applications for navigable waterways within federal conservation system units. With the passing of SB 397, the state would expect to see an increase in the number of requests that we would receive from the federal government and private companies for permits, easements, material flow contracts, and possibly even leases. The same process is followed per the established statutes and regulations as if they were for any other public entity or private company applying to utilize state land. In regards to fees for federal agencies, we usually waive those. And those are per regulation that we waive our fees for federal agencies. And then I'm also available to answer any questions that you might have specifically on what I just stated and how our process is for those different authorization types.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Cullis. Let's go to the March 30th letter. And I think I'll start with something that I wanted to hear more about. And at the bottom of the first paragraph there, it says, having discussed your question with personnel with the South Central Regional Office of DNR's Division of Mining, Land, and Water, the following are some of the permits and authorizations that are adjudicated on state-owned submerged lands. And because the context for this question is, you know, if this bill passes and then we have the state management of, you know, this additional acreage across the state, you know, what might look different? What might the state allow? What kind of activities might be permitted through the state management? And so I'd like to hear a little bit more from you on this. And the list includes docks, mooring buoys, boat ramps, navigational aids, scientific equipment, a number of items there, material extraction, outfall lines, intake lines, buried lines, energy production, camps below ordinary high watermark or mean high tide, placement of riprap or seawall, mariculture, long-term anchoring of vessels, fixed cameras for commercial, scientific, and other purposes, anchor bolts or bollards to tie things off, abandoned derelict vessels, boat storage, or cross-country travel.
Chair Tarr, so the authorizations, these different types of authorizations that we'd be seeing are things that we already see. So we're assuming that within these areas that the federal government would then have to come to us to get authorized because they are state-owned navigable waterways. These are the types of authorizations that would either be authorized through a permit or lease. So for instance, a dock that could be used for, I know we have some for, let's see, seaplanes that might be doing tour guiding operations, they would come to us. And if it's a smaller dock, they would get a permit from us that maybe typically they would have gone to the federal government to get a permit to utilize that area. So those are some of the types of authorizations or activities. I don't know if I'm fully answering your question, though.
No, thank you. That's very helpful and does provide some clarity. And I think what would be concerning to folks, you know, not so much changing the relationship now where, you know, basically we would have to go to the feds. Under this relationship, the feds would have to come to us, and we're talking about, you know, federal conservation areas, so they do have this protected status. So one would hope that that means, you know, the activities that they would be seeking to have permitted or allowed, you know, would be consistent with the conservation nature of the land area. But I think the one that I would wonder a little bit more about is the extraction, you know, sort of material extraction or extraction. You know, I guess, could you see a circumstance under which, you know, this bill passes and then we start to see significantly different activity in an area that we hadn't previously seen before?
Chair Tarr, you know, I think with the material extraction, that's a really good question. We would go to the federal agency, the upland owner, just like we currently do now, to seek public input and agency input. Since they would be the upland owner, we would go to them to find out maybe some concerns they might have about that activity in particular. You know, material extraction is something that requires a site designation, so that goes through a full public an agency process. We have to follow a statute that's 3805-945 that requires multitudes of steps and input that we must get from different entities across the state before we can authorize such an activity. So there would be some levels of, I guess, precautions or fail-proof situations where we could work with other entities before authorizing those types of activities.
Any other questions from committee members? Okay, I'm not seeing any. I know Mr. Walker was also available online, and Mr. Walker, you are the individual who signed this letter, so I wanted to invite you to provide any comments or prepared statement.
Thank you, Chair Tarr. For the record, Jim Walker, I am the Chief of the Public Access Assertion and Defense Section of the Division of Mining, Land, and Water within the Alaska Department of Natural Resources. I don't have anything to add to what the committee has already heard this morning regarding the types of permits and applications and authorizations that we could see within federal areas. But again, you know, this list that was provided in my letter dated March 30th was a more general response to a general inquiry about the types of things that we do statewide. regarding any particular type of permit in any particular type of area, you know, that's going to, as Christy indicated, involve a lot of, you know, particularized and individual assessment before that authorization or permit or whatever is issued by the department. We have various statutory and regulatory steps that we would have to undertake, providing public notice, public input, input from the adjoining landowners, et cetera, so that, you know, just because this bill is passed, I think it would be incorrect to assume that suddenly everything is green light to any type of activity. They are still going to have to go through our thorough process here at DNR. Thank you, Chair Tarr. That's all the statement that I would make, and I'm certainly happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Walker. Appreciate it. And we do have a question from Rep. Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is, if 397 were to see its passage, and then the state would have a role in permitting these different types of activities, I'm referring to the activities listed on the list there. My question is, has there been a problem, a significant problem, in getting these types of activities passed under the previous structure where it was the federal government that was the primary permit distributor? And is this then 397 a specific response to a problem the state's been having in permitting these types of things?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I would say that we receive numerous complaints from individuals who are attempting to do certain things that are permissible on state submerged lands when those state submerged lands fall within the boundaries of federal CSUs. They have come to us on numerous occasions with complaints about overreaching federal actions, things of that nature. Further, we have seen statewide a complete lack of applications from the federal authorities to conduct activities on state submerged lands or to construct infrastructure on state lands that they know would require a particularized state permit. I think the answer to your question is that we have received numerous complaints. We know that the federal government is not presently going through the process. House Bill 397 would make it crystal clear those waters covering submerged lands that are owned by the state that would be that both private citizens and the federal government would need to look to the state for proper authorizations, and that we could hopefully, by the clarity that House Bill 397 gives, avoid the confusion and ambiguity within the public's mind of where state jurisdiction begins and ends and where federal jurisdiction begins and ends. I hope that's responsive to your question, Representative Ortiz.
Yes, thank you very much. For the time being, it suffices.
Well, I would love to add on to that question then and just ask, could you share a specific example of a circumstance where you received one of those complaints? Because I think it would help, you know, if there was some tangible examples, it would help connect some dots here.
Absolutely. The one that comes to mind immediately, and there are several others, but a situation at Crescent Lake in Lake Clark National Park and Preserve, a very large lake within the park, a very popular destination. The area surrounding Crescent Lake was not covered by any valid pre-statehood withdrawal that would explicitly defeat state title. So the state of Alaska owns the submerged lands. For up to the present time, or rather recent memory, the federal government has denied applications to various commercial guides and other outfits who wish to either place mooring buoys within on Crescent Lake and then attached to the bottom of Crescent Lake, the submerged lands underneath, to facilitate their commercial guide operations. Further, have been prevented from storing boats below ordinary high water mark during the winter months, as it was up until the state has gotten involved in this. Various commercial guides were required to fly their boats in at the beginning of the open water season and fly them out before the winter. That could be accomplished either by sling load with a helicopter, which is a very, very costly thing, or they would, in some instances, strap them on the bottom of fixed-wing aircraft, which is not particularly safe. By applying to us, the state of Alaska, for these permits to store submerged land, boats below the ordinary high water mark on submerged lands during the winter months, we believe the situation out there is safer. We further believe that, and again, we have not granted every permit that we have received because consideration is given, you know, to the various aesthetic values of Crescent Lake, et cetera. But we have, in fact, granted, I believe, two permits for winter boat storage, as well as granted one permit application for a mooring buoy permit out on Crescent Lake. These were directly in response to public complaints about the federal government dictating what could and could not happen on state submerged lands.
Okay. I feel that sounded familiar. I think that might have been the example that was shared in our first meeting. And I'm just wondering if you have any other examples or if they are similar in nature to this Crescent Lake example. And is that the kind of thing that the state would like to be able to do and not, have to deal with the federal government to have permitted?
That is an example. Another example I might give, Chair Tarr, if it pleases the committee, is in Geographic Bay, which is off of the Katmai National Park and Preserve. In an area where the state of Alaska owns the tidelands and, in fact, owns all of the submerged lands under Geographic Bay, we received a complaint. This has been it might have been last season or the season before, where a fishing vessel, a commercial fishing vessel, was getting ready to place nets in compliance with state law on the waters in Geographic Bay above state-owned submerged lands, and they were told by federal law enforcement authorities that if they did so, they would be cited for this. Because of the threat of criminal prosecution, forewent those commercial opportunities to bring in a catch. And it is a situation where that is clearly something that is permissible under state law. This particular fisherman was acting completely in compliance with state law, but we have overreaching federal authorities interfering with their livelihood. That would be another example. A third example would come from us to us from various locations where commercial guides are undertaking bear viewing and other activities on state submerged lands, not in areas where the federal government owns the submerged lands, but on state submerged lands where federal law enforcement has directed them that they could not engage in certain camping and other activities that they are permitted to do so under state law. I think that these three examples give a sampling of the types of complaints that we are presently receiving from the public and give sort of a character of the type of regulatory involvement that the state of Alaska would have with these matters upon the passage of House Bill 397.
Thank you. Representative Story has a question.
Yes, thank you. And through the chair, can you tell me a couple of things on your examples? The first one, why did the federal government deny these applications and the boats not having storage? What were their concerns? And I have a follow-up question after that. Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Story, I do not know specifics of why those permits were denied to the operators on Crescent Lake. My suspicion is, based upon other dealings in connection with Crescent Lake, that various aesthetics, such as wilderness value, soundscapes, viewscapes, etc., that those are the types of rationale that are often given for denying permits of this nature. But with that caveat, I do not know the particulars of why the federal government would not allow those operators those permits.
Follow-up. Yeah, thank you. I would think they'd be concerned about anything on the boat being in the waters, get seeping into the waters, but I'm not sure about that. And if you had any of those other examples, if you knew why the federal government did not allow that, I'm wondering if this bill is allowed to go forward, it seems like the state, it has a zero fiscal note, if I'm remembering correctly, and it seems like there would be a lot more personnel needed. So if you could comment on that, I'd appreciate it.
Through the chair, Representative Story, first to the physical note comment. What this bill essentially does is memorialize what has existed since the date of statehood. That the state of Alaska, pursuant to the Equal Footing Doctrine, the Federal Submerged Lands Act, and the Alaska Statehood Act, owns the submerged lands under each and every navigable water within its borders, unless that those submerged lands were withdrawn by a valid pre-statehood withdrawal that explicitly and expressly includes the submerged lands. So what this bill does is it is not adding to anything that the state has, but rather it is confirming. Rather, it is clearly announcing state ownership, management, and control of these areas. So do we expect an uptick in the number of permit applications that we receive? Absolutely. We expect that after. But determining how many more permit applications we are going to see, the workload associated with that is very speculative at this juncture. I think that in time, with the passage of 397, if it happens, we will see more and more, and as we come back to this legislature, at the beginning of each session, should House Bill 397 pass, when we make our annual report as to additional submerged lands that should be included, we can also report on its effect on resources within the Division of Mining, Land, and Water in connection with permitting authorizations and other activities. To your other point, the first part of your question, when you asked for the rationale behind some of the other examples I gave, with Geographic Bay, I think part of the problem is a perceptual one. Oftentimes, federal employees come to Alaska, having served in other parks and preserves, refuges, etc., in the lower 48. And when they come to Alaska, they assume that the rules in Alaska are very similar to the rules that they experienced within the lower 48. They are unaware, at many times, about Anilka. They are, in many cases, unaware of the sturgeon opinions. They are unaware that Alaska is unique and that the rules governing Alaska are unique. As a result, they apply what are principles and guidelines for law enforcement, etc., that are valid on parks, preserves, refuges, et cetera, in the lower 48, but they are unaware of the Alaska-specific laws regarding regulation. So you have a situation where folks are unaware of the state's ownership of these submerged lands. With House Bill 397, the Alaska legislature would be making a bold statement asserting state ownership, management, and control, and would be clearly planting the state flag on what is ours, what has been ours since the date of statehood, so that everyone can understand where state property is located, where state management, ownership, and control should be respected and complied with.
Follow-up. Thank you for that. And through the chair, I was wondering, and it might have been something that Rep. Ortiz was alluding to, as how many of these complaints, so to speak, do happen, and like the and how difficult are they to resolve? You gave the example of the person wanting to place nets down, and then federal government saying they can't do that. Is it a matter of phone calls and clarifying things, or does it get as complicated as in Mr. Sturgeon's case? So I'd like to have an get a feel for how often this happens and how are these issues resolved.
Through the chair, Representative Story, we do not keep specific numbers. We have not kept statistics for this in the past. However, I would say this. In no instance that I am aware of has anything ever been solved with a telephone call. It usually involves elevating this to the highest levels, both our commissioner with the Department of Natural Resources, with the commissioner of Fish and Game, and usually letters are exchanged with very high-ranking federal officials, and usually they contain the threat of litigation. Usually that type of brinksmanship is required to force the federal government, when they are wrong in these situations, to step down. It usually takes that type of escalation. I know it did with Geographic Bay and others. In those types of situations, I think that we are making crystal clear where exactly are the boundaries of state-owned submerged lands under navigable in fact and tidally influenced waters, and so that we will be making much clearer our position, and I believe that that clarity is going to benefit not only the general public, but it's also going to benefit intergovernmental relations, as we have clearly and unequivocally delineated where we believe those property lines are, so that this will be a resource for everyone. And, you know, in that respect, you know, good fences can make good neighbors.
Thank you.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As a follow-up to Representative Story's question, I understand your answer to the extent that there aren't specific fiscal notes, because if we were to adopt or pass HB 397, the added costs, the added perhaps personnel that would be needed in order to start being involved, having the state involved in this permitting process, it's an undetermined number that you could, you know, it's pretty difficult to predict. However, is it safe to say that if we were to pass 397 and take over the long list of activities that you list in the letter there regarding permits and authorizations, that it certainly would bring a significant added cost to the state, and that would also be not including any potential litigation that might come across the state's docket, if you will, in relationship to people not agreeing with the permitting decisions for whatever whatever decision they might make, that the state might make. So I guess what I'm saying is it's pretty safe to say that we would be encountering a significant fiscal responsibility in relationship to taking over these permitting activities that are listed in the letter dated March 30th. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I respectfully disagree. I do not think that it will be additional financial costs to the department, and I'll explain my answer. Presently, with the uncertainty and the numerous clouds on state title, we are forced to litigate and litigate and litigate cases to vindicate those rights that we were conveyed at the date of statehood. We are forced by federal intransigence to sue and litigate throughout the state. With this legislation, with House Bill 397, what we are essentially saying is these lands are ours. These lands have been ours since the date of statehood, and here are boundaries and borders and great particular detail about what we are claiming. In that situation, the federal government has two choices to make. One, it can acquiesce in our determinations. It can agree with our determinations. Or two, if they don't like it, they can sue us, because we are asserting the ownership of these lands. So, to explain how this is played out, because as I've indicated, nothing within this bill adds to the state's land holdings. These are all lands that came to Alaska as of the date of statehood. And so these are lands that the DNR is charged already with the obligations of permitting, etc. This isn't adding anything new. Rather, it is just clarifying the extent of state ownership. So if we look at the Crescent Lake example that I gave, in that instance, when we received an application for a mooring buoy, or we received an application for a boat storage permit, we, as part of our regulatory process, gave the upland owners notice of dependency of these applications and gave them the opportunity to comment. With Crescent Lake, we received a comment from the National Park Service that they didn't think it was a good idea for us to do this, but they did not say we couldn't. They did not say that we owned these submerged lands. Hence, I think that that is an example where our bold assertion, our bold claiming of state lands brings certainty, brings clarity, brings quietude to the state title. The same, I think, is also true with Geographic Bay, where when these reports came to us that a fisherman essentially was being deprived of his livelihood, we took bold, immediate action claiming what is ours. All 397 does is clarifies and delineates what we believe we claim there. But we made bold statements, took bold actions, and the federal government backed down. I think that the clarity of this might, in fact, reduce state costs in the long run, and this will result in savings to us, you know, in terms of litigation costs, in terms of the time and manpower devoted to various emergencies and emerging threats, you know, or claims of overreach by the federal government. I believe that this certainty is going to reduce our costs in the long run.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Walker. Let's leave that there so that we can get to our invited testimony before we have to wrap up today. Mr. Sturgeon, if you could please go ahead and we're looking at about 12, 13 minutes left here for our meeting, and so I would like to have some time for both you and Mr. Sewright, if possible. So welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My presentation is 5 minutes, so I'll try to read fast. First of all, good morning, Chair Tyre and committee members. For the record, my name is John Sturgeon. I've been in Alaska since 1970. It's an honor to appear for the committee today. Today, I was asked to talk about a 2019 U.S. Supreme Court decision on Alaska's navigable waters. First, a little background. The concept of navigable waters goes back to the kings of England and the emperors of Rome. As was the case then and is still in much of Alaska, the rivers, lakes, and tidelands were the main transportation routes in those days. Some 80% of Alaska towns and villages do not have road access. Mighty rivers such as the Yukon, Kuskokwim, Stikine, Susitna, to name a few, have been Alaska's superhighways since the first indigenous people arrived in Alaska. To many Alaskans, these water highways are just as important today as they were 1,000 years ago. Our founding fathers, in the very beginning of our country, put those navigable waters into a public trust to be managed by the states. When Alaska became a state under the Equal Protection Clause, we were to receive title to all the navigable waters in our state. My story started in 2007 while I was moose hunting on a tributary of the Yukon River near Eagle within the Yukon-Charlie National Preserve, an area I have hunted for over 50 consecutive years. I was operating a small 10-foot hovercraft when I was approached by two National Park Service enforcement officers. Unbeknownst to me, hovercrafts were prohibited nationwide on National Park Service lands. I informed them I was on state-owned navigable waters and I didn't think they had jurisdiction. They acknowledged it was state-owned, but since the uplands were owned by the National Park Service, they said they had management rights. Fortunately, I did not get a citation. That started a 13-year, $1.6 million journey through the federal court system, which, by the way, was paid for by thousands of donations from all across Alaska. My case was one of 8,000 submitted in 2019, was also just one of 41 they accepted. That's one half of 1%. It ended with two unanimous Supreme Court decisions. The Washington Post had several stories on the decision and couldn't find a single case in U.S. Supreme Court history that had two unanimous decisions. What did these two unanimous Supreme Court decisions say? Let me give you a few quotes. And rivers function as roads of Alaska to the extent unknown anyplace else in the country. Over three quarters of Alaska's 300 communities live in regions unconnected to the state's road system. Residents of those areas include many of Alaska's poorest citizens who rely on the rivers for access to necessities like food and water. Justice Elaine Kagan. It also said all navigable waters in Alaska will be managed by the state of Alaska, not the federal government. Continue to say, and all inholdings, especially navigable waters and submerged lands, are exempt from federal management. If the federal government wants to manage them, they have to buy them. They also said that since state, native, and private inholdings are not part of the park, therefore the regulations do not apply. These inholdings should be treated the same as they would be prior to ANILCA. They also said the courts made some very broad statements on ANILCA, saying it was a grand compromise and it had two stated goals. This is the quote from the Supreme Court. First, provide sufficient protection for the national interest in the scenic, natural, cultural, and environmental values of the public land in Alaska. And second, provide adequate opportunity for the satisfaction of the economic and social needs of the state of Alaska and its people. And finally, my favorite quote in the Supreme Court decision, the last sentence, said, this is a quote, that means Sturgeon can again rev up his hovercraft in search of moose. Justice Elaine Kagan. I've been telling my wife for the last 4 years that the Supreme Court ordered me to go moose hunting. I hadn't worked so far, but maybe next year. You would think that with two unanimous U.S. Supreme Court decisions would get the federal government, federal bureaucrats' attention. So what has happened in the past 3 years since my unanimous Supreme Court decision in regards to the feds passing title of navigable waters to the state? Unfortunately, absolutely nothing. Not one navigable water has been transferred to the state of Alaska since that 2019 U.S. Supreme Court decision. Since statehood, only 9% of navigable waters in Alaska have been transferred from federal ownership to the state. That's 63 years. At that rate, it will take 600 years. All the other states have gotten title to their navigable waters years ago. It would appear the federal bureaucrats are thumbing their nose not only to the state of Alaska, but the Supreme Court as well. In my opinion, the feds are intentionally not passing title to the states so they can continue to manage the state's navigable waters. Why would Alaska prefer state management of our navigable waters over federal management? For one thing, the federal government manages for maximum biodiversity. The state manages for maximum sustained yield. That's very important to commercial fishermen, to sport fishermen, and other folks. That means the state has a lot more tools at its disposal, such as intensive management, hatcheries, and fishery stocking, to name a few. I urge you to pass House Bill 397 out of committee and to send a message to the federal government. They need to pass title of all navigable waters to the state of Alaska. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
Thank you so much, Mr. Sturgeon. And I think so that we can definitely hear from Mr. Seawright, if you could go now, and then we'll come back and spend a couple minutes on questions with both of you. Mike? Seawright?
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah, I wanted to see if you could give your comments, please, because we're getting short on time, and then we would see if there are any questions for you or Mr. Sturgeon at the end.
Okay, I understand. May I start now?
Yes, please.
Well, may it please you, Chair Carr, and members of the committee, I am Mike Seawright. I support this legislation, and I'll tell you why. Let me start with my background. I'm a lifelong Alaskan. More importantly, for purposes of the information you're gathering, is for many years I was lead attorney for the State of Alaska Department of Law, indeed litigating and otherwise dealing with this navigable waters situation. I was lead counsel for the cases that determined the navigability standards for Alaska through the courts, through the federal courts. One was the Gulfcana River case. Another was the Matanuska River case. Before that, there was the Kandik Nation Rivers case. Interestingly, John Sturgeon happened to be wanting to hunt his moose along the or using the Nation River. So that was, for court's purposes, already determined applicable. What I want to emphasize is this. As Mr. Sturgeon stated, the Susitna River, Yukon, Kuskokwim, et cetera, those are super highways for Alaska. Well, that's the federal government, at least in terms of navigability, does not question the most of the part of those main rivers. What this is a lot about is about the roads in Alaska, and that's what the U.S. Supreme Court recognized in the Sturgeon case. The roads are like the Gulfcana River, the Nation River, used by smaller boats and for very important travel as the only road system. And that's why those are important. And that's why there are so many listings, as you see in the bill, because there are a lot of waterways that come within that category of these important roads. The federal courts, all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court in the Gulfcana River case, what they agreed with the state on is, for purposes of Alaska and when Alaska became a state, commercial travel, or the susceptibility, the possibility of commercial travel by small watercraft. We're talking about inflatable boats, 12 to 14 feet, small river boats, airboats, which existed in Alaska for many, many years, canoes that are 17, 19 feet. For purposes of Alaska, those are the commercial watercraft, or they're included within the commercial watercraft specification. That's decided by law. So we're talking about relatively small waters, like the headwaters of the Nation River that John Sturgeon mentioned, up to the Alaska-Canadian border. I've seen the photos. Those waters are smaller than Campbell Creek, but yet these small boats can use those waters, including in times of pulling the boats up the water. It's a lot easier than through the alders. So I'm emphasizing this because, as I see it, the importance of this bill is listing the state's position on these waterways. It's simply giving notice to the federal government in a way that's recognized by the Alaska legislature that these smaller waters are included. And a lot of the waters listed in the bill, you know, probably more than 50% are very large waters. But giving notice to the federal government, it will not surprise the federal government because they know the state's position, but the state before hasn't listed all the waterways, and it's not, it's not a position taken by the state of Alaska through the Alaska legislature. So we're talking about an important bill here. We're talking about lakes that are usually well over 50 acres, pretty sizable. I know there's a Tordrilla Mountain Lodge out of Judd Lake near where I have a cabin, and that lake isn't a huge lake, maybe a mile and a half long, but there's been commercial traffic with boats through the lodge and other commercial guides out there since the 60s. So that's what we're talking about. I want to make one last point because I know there's limited time. This is, in my mind, this is not a Dunleavy administration proposal. This would just as easily be a Bill Walker proposal or a left era proposal. In my mind, this is pretty much a no-brainer as a bill that you'll see. It's something that, well, among others, I know U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan would support it. You're going to be talking with him pretty soon because he was Attorney General part of the time I was litigating this stuff, and he's a very strong supporter of Alaska's assertion of its navigable waters. By ownership of the submerged lands, Alaska also, under the court decisions, including the Sturgeon decision, has management power, as Mr. Sturgeon pointed out. These are conservative designations made by DNR in this bill. They can be amended as the bill language provides. I did not have anything to do with drafting this bill, but it's very well drafted. I've reviewed it. It's carefully drafted. So I also urge you to pass House Bill 397 out of committee. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Sewright. We really appreciate your testimony. And we just have a moment or two here. I don't know if we have any questions. No questions. Okay, we're not seeing any questions here this morning. Really appreciate everyone joining us. We will be in touch for any future follow-up meetings. I think this has really helped with the learning component of this. And I think, you know, just that's been where we needed to start. To familiarize ourselves with the legislation and what it might do. So with no further business to come before us, we will go ahead and adjourn at 10:51 a.m.